In this part of Focus 580, we will give you the opportunity to do a little exploring here, metaphorically speaking, of one of the most exotic places on Earth, a place that is rich in plant and animal species that don't exist, many of them, a great many of them, don't exist anywhere else on Earth, a place with a very interesting, unique culture. A place that is an island off the coast of Africa. The place we're talking about is Madagascar. And we'll be talking about Madagascar this morning with Peter Tyson. He's a science journalist. He's online producer of NOVA, the PBS science series. He's also written for Atlantic Monthly, The New York Times, other magazines and newspapers. And he's written a book about Madagascar, which is titled The Eighth Continent. It is published by William Morrow, and is very interesting reading. You might want to take a look at it. It should be out there in the bookstores. And if you have questions, of course, as we talk, they are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Again, if you match the numbers on the phones with the numbers on the phone with the letters, you get WILL, which may or may not make it easier to remember, 333-WILL, and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Mr. Tyson, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us today.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
To start out, let's talk in very basic terms for folks who maybe wouldn't even know where Madagascar was. I did mention it's an island. It's one of the largest islands in the world. It's located 450 miles, right, off the coast of Africa.
About 250 miles.
250 miles.
Southeast Africa. Oh,
okay.
If you can picture a map of Africa, it's down in the southeast corner off Mozambique.
Mm. And it is among the largest islands in the world up there with Borneo.
That's right. It's the fourth largest
Greenland
island in the world,
yeah,
after Greenland, New Guinea, and Borneo.
Mm-hmm.
It's 1,000 miles long, which is pretty long. I mean, it would stretch from New York to Tampa, Florida, with its west coast pushing into Ohio. That's a quite large island.
Mm-hmm. And big enough so that as you go from one place to another on the island, it's big enough and stretches in degrees of latitude enough so that there are even very distinct ecosystems that exist within this island. So not only are we talking about plants and animals that are in Madagascar that aren't anyplace else, but there are also some that are just in one part of Madagascar.
That's exactly right. I mean, you can find endemic species, meaning species that are only found there, within certain forests, even within certain parts of forests in Madagascar. And there are whole landscapes that are completely unique to Madagascar, such as the Spiny Desert, which is found in the south. It's found nowhere else in the world. It has 95% of the plants in there are unique completely to that part of the island. So that makes it very unique.
All islands, I think, are special in this way because they are isolated. And yet it seems that Madagascar is even more so than a lot of other places that one could think of.
That's right. It's been isolated for at least 40 million and probably more like 80 or 100 million years out in the Indian Ocean all by itself, which is big reason why a lot of these species are only found there. Their species from Africa have never had a chance to get over there because they evolved too late to make the crossing across the Mozambique Channel. And so you won't find any of the lions or cheetahs or other large cats of Africa there. You won't find elephants or rhinos. You won't find monkeys. You won't find poisonous snakes. They all evolved too late to make the crossing. And so Madagascar is truly isolated out there.
That's interesting that it can be that close to Africa, and yet all those sorts of things that you think of as being so characteristic of Africa in terms of the fauna, at least, they're simply not there.
That's very true.
And as I understand it, when we talk about how the island formed, that it was at first actually part of Africa. It was connected to Africa.
That's right. It was it abutted present-day Kenya and Tanzania, and then about 165 million years ago, it began to break apart and drift southeast to where it is today, about 250 miles off of Mozambique.
And do I remember this right? Was there also a time at which it touched on the Indian subcontinent?
Absolutely. There was a long period, probably 40 or 50 million years, when Madagascar was actually attached to India in a place called Greater India. And then eventually India broke free and drifted north and slammed into Asia about 50 million years ago, leaving Madagascar all alone.
Hmm. Another interesting feature of the place is that apparently human beings are certainly newcomers, that as far as we know, that human beings have lived on Madagascar for no more than 2,000 years.
Yes, and that's an astonishing late period, especially considering man or humans are supposed to have arisen in nearby Africa, only about 1,000 miles away. And yet human beings colonized the whole rest of the world, including the Arctic and the Mongolian steppe and all these other less habitable places long before they ever got to Madagascar.
Hmm. And also, one might imagine, since Madagascar is close to Africa, that the people, the Malagasy people, might be of African origin, but in fact, they're not. Apparently, the people of Madagascar came from Indonesia.
That's right. It's one of the big mysteries of Madagascar. I mean, here's Africa 250 miles away. Indonesia is probably more than 3,500 miles away. And yet the original people that come to Madagascar clearly were Indonesians. And we know that because the language itself is Malayo-Polynesian in origin. There's only one language on Madagascar, which is another mystery. When you think New Guinea has 700 languages, Madagascar only has one. But there are other signs of Indonesian origins in Madagascar, including terraced rice paddies and outrigger canoes and the rectangular house, which is all over Madagascar. You won't find the round hut common in Africa. But it's a real mystery as to why Indonesians were the first to colonize Madagascar and not Africans.
Mm-hmm. I guess I made this comment to a colleague, and they said, well, you know, people who live on islands, they know about boats. So maybe it's not that surprising that the Indonesians would have been seafaring enough to make it that way, and that perhaps people on the African coast, while they would have no doubt gone out into the water to fish, the idea of going that far, even if it is only a couple of hundred miles, maybe they just either saw no reason for it or just didn't have the tradition of covering that kind of mileage on the sea, and or maybe for other reasons, who knows, that it just the people just didn't go that way, that they came from the other direction.
Well, that's true. The Indonesians did have an ocean-going outrigger canoe technology that would have allowed them to go that far. But there's another factor, which is that the winds and currents tend towards the continent of Africa, which is why you saw that big storm that hit Mozambique and caused all the flooding last year. That first hit Madagascar. You didn't hear about it much, but that first raked across Madagascar and then hit Mozambique. And that kind of tendency has mitigated against boats going away from Africa towards Madagascar. But I should say, though, that Africans did play a very large part in the colonization of Madagascar. It just didn't seem that they were the original people. Later on, they did play a major part in the colonization and establishment of the culture there. And so today you find people who are both very African-looking and very Indonesian-looking.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Peter Tyson. He is a science journalist. He's been a science writer for 17 years. He is also an online producer of NOVA, the PBS science series, and is the author of this book that we're talking about here this morning that is about the island of Madagascar, which is titled The Eighth Continent. It's published by William Morrow and is out there in the bookstores, and it's quite interesting. Questions also welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. The title refers, I guess, to the fact that that Madagascar is big enough and the biodiversity is rich enough so that it's fair to think about it in those terms. As a continent, even though there are other continents that are much bigger.
That's true. I mean, it's so continent-like in the fact that it's got all these millions of species, that many of which are found only there, and these diverse landscapes, mountains that soar to 8,000 to 9,000 feet, and you know, fully 1,000 miles long. That some have considered it the eighth continent.
So, how is it that you ended up going there? Was it some place that you had thought about going for some time?
Well, I think for, like a lot of people, Madagascar, to me, embodied the most exotic place in the world I could go to. But it really came about when I first went there for Earthwatch, an organization based in Maynard, Massachusetts, that sends volunteers into the field to work with scientists. They sent me to write an article to Madagascar back in 93, and I subsequently went 4 more times, both for the book and for NOVA.
So you had the opportunity to, when you were there, to meet with some scientists, for, people from different places who are interested in this place, categorizing and documenting its life, various life forms. Are there still things there that actually have not been identified? Do you think there are yet unnamed species in this place?
Absolutely. I mean, the herpetologist I went to, who studies reptiles and amphibians, every time he goes, he finds new species that have never been identified, never been described by scientists. New lemurs are even being found, lemurs being the primates that are found on Madagascar. They're still finding new species of lemurs, which is very amazing, really. Plants the same way. There's new species coming up all the time.
I guess that this place becomes a very interesting laboratory for one to study the issue of evolution, because we're assuming that some of the animals did indeed come from Africa at the point where the island was part of Africa, and then perhaps also some came from the Indian subcontinent at the point that it had been the other way. But then for this very long period of time, it was isolated. It was there in the Indian Ocean, and it's possible that some animals, some birds might have been able to fly there. Some animals might have hitched a ride on some debris that was floating in the water. But that apparently is not enough to explain the great diversity that's there. You can't, everything that's there could not possibly have been descended from things. Well, they didn't come over that way. I guess the issue is that they, in fact, everything that's there is descended one way or another from things that managed to get there, probably mostly when it was touching one of the other land masses. And it really raises some interesting and difficult questions about how exactly that happened, how it is you managed to get this kind of diversity from what we can know about what the original inhabitants of this place was going back a long, long way.
That's absolutely true. I mean, you've got the lemurs, for instance, which hadn't evolved by the time Madagascar had become isolated out in the Indian Ocean. So the question is, how did lemurs get there? And it seems clear that they must have floated across on vegetation, say a tree that was washed out in a storm from Africa. And that's the way most scientists believe they did come. But interestingly enough, they think that only one crossing may have been made by lemurs, one single crossing that resulted in all these myriad forms of lemurs, of which there are more than 50 kinds in Madagascar. And it's possible, it's actually possible that a single pregnant female lemur came across on some vegetation, landed on Madagascar, and propagated species that went on to become all these 50 different kinds. It's astonishing to believe, but the reason they think that happened is that genetic studies have shown recently that all the lemurs on Madagascar are actually more closely related to each other than they are to any other lemur-like creature elsewhere in the world.
Hmm. And how long is it thought that process took?
Well, the early lemurs probably arose about in the age of mammals, probably about 58 million years ago. So at some point after that, they made the crossing to Madagascar. And as I said, that was probably a single event. But then to evolve into all these various species, it obviously took tens of millions of years.
Hmm. Is there precedent for such a thing happening anyplace else?
Well, I think islands are prone to this kind of thing, especially isolated oceanic islands. Hmm. But you mentioned about islands having species that were there when the landmass broke away. The Seychelles, for instance, have creatures that probably were there when the landmass broke away from Madagascar and that region, the Seychelles being isolated Indian Ocean islands, because there's no other way to account for their being there. That includes some frogs that are on the Seychelles and whatnot.
One of the other things that you write about is that apparently they know that in the past there were examples of animals, big ones, or bigger than what they have now. If, for example, there were lemurs that are much bigger than the lemurs that are there now. There were these enormous flightless birds called elephant birds. There was this animal called the pygmy hippo that are now all gone. All of the biggest animals on the place are now gone. And again, one of the interesting questions that biologists and others are looking at is what happened? Well, why did these animals, these big animals, become extinct? Maybe we can talk a little bit about them. I'm certainly interested in hearing about the elephant bird, and then maybe we can go on to this issue of what it is that scientists think happened to these animals.
Well, the elephant bird was a half-ton beast. I mean, it had legs like tree trunks, and it thundered across the savannas of Madagascar and was a grazer, grazing on and browser, pretty much filling the niche of the animals that never made it from Africa, such as the giraffes and whatnot. And its egg alone could make an omelet for 50 people. These are giant rugby ball-sized eggs, which are occasionally still found in Madagascar. They still wash out of stream beds and whatnot, usually in fragments, but occasionally they'll still find a whole egg, and they're very valuable now. But that was a fascinating bird, and yes, it was much larger than anything out there today. All these animals are sort of termed, lumped under the term megafauna, which is, in Madagascar, is any animal that weighed over 25 pounds. And as I said, the elephant bird weighed 1,000 pounds, a really giant ostrich, essentially. And as to why they went extinct, that is a big question. Scientists are still trying to answer that question. It seems that humans had something to do with it because they arrived 2,000 years ago, and sometime within the last 2,000 years, all these animals went extinct. So it seems like it's pretty obvious that man had something to do with it. But it's a tough question because the population was very small early on, and there are no signs of great kill sites of these animals like you find bison kill sites in the Americas, or you find moa, the big bird of New Zealand. You find these big heaps of bones there. But in Madagascar, the number of bones that show unequivocal signs of being butchered is only 9.
Hmm.
So it's still a big mystery.
So it may have been some other change in the environment that came about as the result of the human beings arriving, not the fact that people hunted these animals down and ate them all.
Exactly. One paleoecologist, is a man who studies ancient landscapes, he's come up with the theory that it was really a recipe, what he calls a recipe for disaster, which was several different things, including climate change and habitat loss and hunting, that all contributed to this to the loss of these megafauna.
Hmm. And the same would be true of the giant lemurs and of the pygmy hippo. That was, in a sense, all the same issue, and not so much that people were eating them.
Exactly. I mean, there are signs that these animals are eaten, but only very few. And so it seems like it was probably a combination of things that led to their demise.
Mm-hmm. So these animals, were they animals that essentially walked on to Madagascar at the point where it was touching another landmass?
Well, that's a good question, and it probably differs for each one of those animals. It's possible that the elephant birds did walk across from Africa to Madagascar, or potentially walked west from Africa to Madagascar when all these continents were connected in Gondwanaland, the ancient supercontinent. Boa constrictors are the same way. You think about, it's a very big mystery as to why the Americas have boa constrictors and Madagascar and no place else on Earth have boa constrictors, just those two places. The reason is they probably did slide across when they were all connected. But many others, the lemurs obviously came later because they hadn't evolved yet. So even the giant lemurs probably came originally as a smaller lemur and then evolved into the giant lemurs by sea.
Mm-hmm. So were there many examples, you think, of animals that in a sense, in the same way, they walked there when it was all part of one landmass, or when it was connected to a larger landmass, then it breaks away, they become isolated, and for some reason they actually survive there, but die off elsewhere. So here what we're doing is we're finding very ancient animals that have managed to survive there that we would have found in other places, but in the other places, they became, for whatever reasons, they became extinct. But here, they managed to hang in.
That's exactly right. I mean, lemurs have survived only because the monkeys and apes, the more intelligent primates, didn't ever make it to Madagascar. If they had, they would have overwhelmed the lemurs and they would be gone. Same with the boas. There are no pythons in Madagascar, and they're more sort of highly evolved creatures. And you do find those in Africa, but you don't find them in Madagascar. So the boa has been able to survive.
Mm-hmm. And I guess that it's also a place that, relatively speaking, doesn't have a lot of poisonous species, things that are deadly to human beings.
No, and that's one of the wonderful things about going to Madagascar. If you ever want to go to Madagascar, you can tramp through the forest with impunity because there's very few things that can hurt you. There are no poisonous snakes. I mean, there are one or two species that are mildly poisonous, but their fangs are way back in the back of their throat and pointing backwards, so your chance of actually getting poisoned are very slim. And that's true with most animals in Madagascar. There's very few things that can hurt you. About the only things are malarial mosquitoes and the crocodile.
Mm-hmm. Does that have something to do with the fact that there were no human beings around for such a long time, and that that animals, that was one thing that the animals there didn't have to protect themselves against?
Yeah, humans and other predators. I mean, there are none of these large predators from, say, Africa that you think of in Africa, and so they didn't need to evolve these poisonous tactics or armor or other. You know, anti-predator tactics.
Hmm. And I guess that also is one of the things that really poses a challenge when you start talking about preservation of animals there, at least in their relationship with human beings. One of the things you talk about in the book is that it's really striking the fact that it seems the animals there don't have a natural fear of human beings, or at least if you compare those with similar sorts of animals that you might, for example, find in Africa, they know that they need to stay away from people. But I gather on Madagascar that animals just don't know that.
Well, that's certainly true for when the first Malagasy arrived. That's probably a big part of the reason why the big megafauna went extinct. They didn't have to run fast because there were no predators of them, the giant lemurs, for instance. They were more like sloth-like creatures that hung in trees. And so they made an easy target for humans. And that's to a lesser extent as you get closer to the present day, because lemurs today will, for the most part, run away from you if you're in a wild part. There are certain private nature reserves where you can get quite close to lemurs that are used to humans. But for the most part, species in Madagascar will move away from you because they've had 2,000 years now of knowing what man can do.
Yeah. We're at our midpoint here. Let me introduce our guest once again. We're talking with Peter Tyson. He's a science writer. He has written for The Atlantic Monthly and The New York Times, other magazines and newspapers. He's online producer of the PBS science series Nova, and is also the author of a book titled The Eighth Continent, Life, Death, and Discovery in the Lost World of Madagascar. It's published by Morrow. Questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have that toll-free line that's good anywhere around the continental United States that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And we have a caller in Boston on line number 4. We'll talk with him right now. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi, great show. Long time listener, first time caller.
Great.
Got a question for Mr. Tyson. Mr. Tyson, I'm sure you've had a lot of exciting adventures in Madagascar. I was wondering if you could tell me what's the scariest thing that's happened to you there, and also what kind of online resources there might be available to if someone wants to learn more about the continent.
Well, probably the scariest thing that I've had in Madagascar was a big foot infection I had just in my last trip there in June this year. And it was the kind of thing that just came out of the blue. I had a little cut on my foot, and within a day, my foot was half again as big as my other foot. And the infection was rising up my leg and whatnot. And I was deep in the rainforest, far from any town. And so it got kind of dangerous. But within about 2 days, the antibiotics that I had kicked in, and my foot started to get better. And I talk about that on the Nova website because I went for Nova on that trip. And so if you want to read about that nasty foot infection, including pictures, you can check out the Nova website at pbs.org.
Great. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you for the call.
Bye.
And we have somebody else here. This would be Freeport, line number 1. Hello.
Madagascar was ruled by France, correct?
That's right, for about 65 years.
Yeah, I read somewhere where the French Foreign Legion, when they were going toward Indochina, you know, that area, Vietnam ruled by France, why they decided to seize Madagascar also. And it was kind of looked on as a colony, a French colony in the southern area of Africa that could, oppose British influence, you know, in that part of the world. But it was very... not very economically feasible ever.
That's right. It was a French colony from 1895 until 1960, and the French, you know, have to be applauded for helping to pull Madagascar into the modern world. But at the same time, they imposed restrictions on Malagasy that would certainly be considered racist today. And so there was a little of both, good and bad, during that colonial period.
Well, most of them are Muslim, right?
I'm sorry?
They're Muslim, right?
Well, so there is a Muslim contingent in Madagascar, but most of the people in Madagascar are Christian in terms of Western religions. All the people in Madagascar are ancestor worshippers. They believe in ancestors that they're recently dead, become ancestors whom they consult on all matters of importance in life.
I read where they make yearly visits to the tombs of their dead, you know.
That's right. They certainly, several of the tribes in the Central Highlands perform a ceremony called Famadina, which is literally turning the bones.
Yeah.
And they go into the tombs of their relatives and disinter the bodies and rewrap them in new shrouds. And these are big celebrations. They're happy celebrations. They're not mourning. And the idea is to keep the ancestors happy so that they will bestow their advice and benefits on the living through ancestor ceremonies, which is sort of when the Malagasy will sit down and consult the ancestors through ceremonies.
That comes sort of from the Orient, doesn't it? I mean, the ancestor emphasis.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's one of the many signs that the people originally came from the East, the Far East. Ancestor worship is very much a Malayo-Polynesian kind of influence.
Thank you.
All right, thank
You're
you.
Welcome.
Let's go to Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I understand that Madagascar was the site of what's considered by a lot of developing countries one of the earliest examples of biopiracy, specifically with Eli Lilly and the periwinkle plant.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was just wondering if over the years, I believe that was in the 60s, over the years has what's Madagascar's relationship been with pharmaceuticals now? Has it evolved to something? Is it like taking a lead with?
Well, that's a good question. It's true that Eli Lilly basically reaped all the benefits from the rosy periwinkle, which is a native plant in Madagascar that's used to cure childhood leukemia. And very few of those benefits devolved back to the Malagasy. Today, many Malagasy raise rosy periwinkle and sell it. Again, the benefits are not great, and I wouldn't say, although I can't speak with great authority on this, but I wouldn't say that they've really improved things from the first time. On the pharmaceutical company's behalf, you know, on their side, you have to think that they did all the processing of this and determined exactly what they isolated the chemical that's really used in the medicine. But it is true that a lot of this money should have, ethically speaking, gone back to Madagascar.
And they haven't erected any kind of new, regulations, say, as to pharmaceuticals coming into, the rainforest there and looking for leads, drug leads.
I'm sorry, I can't really. I just don't have the information to answer that question. I that's a good question. I would like to know myself. My feeling is probably not to the degree that should be, but I don't know the answer to that.
Another medical related question is: I understood back in '95, a 16-year-old Madagascar boy had the dubious distinction of being the first person to contract bubonic plague that was resistant to antibiotics. And I was just wondering if it had any other cases of it, or are you aware of that one?
I'm not. I certainly haven't heard of any,
further
major cases of bubonic plague in Madagascar. I'm sure it was an isolated event, but that's interesting.
And lastly, and then I'll hang up. I just read real recently that apparently the Masoala National Park is becoming a kind of a model for protecting tropical forests. If you could talk a little bit about that, if you're
Yeah, it's a new national park that was formed up in the northeast, and the largest remaining patch of rainforest in Madagascar back in 97. And it is a model for how to protect landscape while also helping the local people. At least that's the hope. I mean, it's very new, so it'll remain to see how well it goes on. But they're really trying to involve local people in protecting the forest, making money off it through ecotourism. That's really the only way to save it is to involve local people directly, local people who've lived there for generations and consider the forest theirs to use. And so you can't simply rope it off and say, you can't use this forest anymore. It's much better to get local people involved and give them a stake for saving it and actually sort of own it themselves in the sense of making money off it.
Hmm. I'm sorry to interrupt. I'm just going to say this was one of the issues I certainly wanted to get to, because we talked about this great biodiversity of the place and the fact that there are all these plants and animals that aren't found anyplace else. But also one of the issues that you deal with in the book is the degree to which these plants and animals are also endangered. It is a poor place, so one wouldn't be surprised if the people would try to use the resources in whatever way they could.
Absolutely.
But what you'd want to do is see if you can strike some kind of balance to preserve the resources and also use them in a positive way to benefit the people who live there.
That's right. That's exactly true. And Madagascar is one of the poorest nations in the world. You know, the per capita income there is less than $250 a year, which is astonishingly low. And so for the Malagasy to actually conserve these forests, you have to give them means to make money off it. And ecotourism seems to be the most promising way to do that. Bring tourists in, have them go to the forest, spend money, and have the local people benefit that way.
We talked a little bit earlier about the fact that the island has a number of distinct ecosystems within it, and that there are people, and they're different from one place to the next. One of the things that's interesting about it is that there's only one language; everybody speaks the same language. Are there big cultural differences between groups of people living in one place, say as you go north to south or east to west? Are the people that different?
That's a good question. Essentially, not. They do all speak one language, and while there are 18 officially recognized tribes in Madagascar — tribes is not pejorative, by the way, in Madagascar, that term — they are, for the most part, all united by this language and by basic cultural factors. They all believe in ancestor worship, and they are, for the most part, all raise rice. They all keep cattle for funerals. These things all tie them together, and so you don't see huge cultural differences between different areas.
We have another caller coming in here, and maybe I'll just give the telephone number again. If you have questions here, we have about 10 minutes left. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us around the country, 800-222-9455. You'd like to call in, talk with our guest, Peter Tyson. Here's another caller here, also locally in Urbana, line number one. Hello. Oh,
hello. I have heard that there was very serious problem with drinking water and that there's quite a lot of cholera in Madagascar at present. Is that your impression? Or?
Well, it certainly crops up after major cyclones like the one that struck last year in the northeast. It's always a danger. But in general, for tourists who are going to Madagascar, it shouldn't be a problem, because for the most part, you're not going to be drinking the water anyway, because there's plenty of other things that can get you as well. The thing to do is drink bottled water.
You would always drink bottled
absolutely.
Drinks.
Yes, always drink bottled drinks and stay away from the soda. It's awful.
Well, what would you drink?
Well, you can drink the Three Horses beer, which is the national brew if you like beer, and that's available everywhere. You can get bottled Eau Vive, which is just mineral water, anywhere, and so there's plenty of water available.
And if you drink, if you eat the other foods like soup or things with gravy and stuff on them, they wouldn't likely have the cholera. I mean, anything that's been cooked wouldn't have cholera.
You have to make sure it's been cooked long enough. That's one key factor. But if you stay in nicer hotels, and you'll probably be eating foods that have been cooked in water that's been seriously boiled or has been is mineral water. And so for the most part, if you go to the nice hotels and
so you wouldn't hesitate to send novices or anybody else over there this fall? Or?
Absolutely not. I'd highly recommend it.
Yeah, okay. I'm hoping to find a Sierra Club or some similar group that goes there. Do you know, does the Sierra Club have a trip there? Or?
That's a good question. I wouldn't be surprised if they do. I mean,
anyway, I can, yeah. I can
yeah, look it up
out myself.
There's plenty of trips out there, too.
And anyway, I'm glad to hear that there's no problem with
yeah, you just drink
not an insurmountable problem with the drinking.
I'm sorry?
I say I'm glad to hear that it's possible to go there and drink something without getting without risking cholera.
Yeah.
And I hope my son lives in Nairobi. My daughter-in-law lives in Nairobi part of the time. So when I visit her, I'm hoping to go over there.
Well, good luck.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. And again, other questions, welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Tell us, just give us another story that perhaps of an experience that you had, something that you just thought was particularly special, amazing, unique, the kind of thing that maybe says something about the kind of place that Madagascar is.
Well, I suppose one of the most interesting things I've done recently was go into a cave in the north. I did this in May this year, that has the only cave living crocodiles in the world. And, you know, it was so ironic because, as I said earlier, there are very few things that can harm you in Madagascar, but one of them is the Nile crocodile. And I went into this cave that was literally teeming with these crocodiles. We went in there, and it was a mile-long cave, completely dark inside. And we saw footprints everywhere. Luckily, we only came across one crocodile because most of them were further upstream than we ever got. But it was just it was an amazing experience to go in there, turn off our headlamps, and I actually walked up by myself about a half a mile around a bend away from my companions, turned off my light just to feel what it would be like to be in a cave that had the only cave-living crocodile. It was very disturbing, and I quickly turned my light back on and went back to my companions because I just envisioned a big, loud rush of a croc out of the side of this cave towards the water, and I didn't want that experience. So.
I can imagine that it probably wouldn't take very few minutes before you said to yourself, Peter, I don't think this is such a good idea.
Exactly. It wasn't minutes. It was more like seconds.
Here's another caller in Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Would you like to talk briefly about some of these organizations, like I think you called it Earthwatch, that
yes.
Where people can go as a volunteer and experience,
yeah,
and also experience.
And they Earthwatch. This organization is called the Earthwatch Institute, and they send volunteers who are paying volunteers to different parts of the world to work with scientists, help them do their research for usually 2 weeks. And there are several trips to Madagascar that I know that Earthwatch is running this year, one studying lemurs and another one studying the fuso, which is this very unusual carnivore. It's like a cross between a mountain lion and a mongoose, and you can go study that. And I think there are other organizations that do this sort of thing as well. And then, of course, you can go on a regular tour trip kind of to Madagascar.
Do you have any knowledge about what kind of characteristics they look for people to volunteer and that kind of thing?
I think if you're healthy and you know, you don't have any allergies to things that might be cropping up there, then you should be fine. They take all ages and people from very diverse backgrounds. I've been on a lot of them. I used to work for Earthwatch, and so it's a great experience, I can guarantee you.
And I presume they have a website.
They have a website. I think it's www.earthwatch.org.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you. And one needn't have some sort of special training. You don't have to be a botanist, biologist, anything like that.
Exactly. You just have to be healthy and willing to work. Mm-hmm. Because in a lot of these cases, you do work hard, which is the great payback. I mean, I've met Earthwatch volunteers who've gone into the field and not done very much, and they get angry because they've spent a lot of money to do the work, and they really want to get involved. And in most cases, they do. They get very much involved, and it's a very unique experience.
The one strategy that a place like Madagascar could use to generate income is indeed to get people to come there, ecotourism. is becoming very big in a lot of places. And I imagine it's in a way kind of a double-edged sword, because you have to be very careful about how many people come and the impact that they have on the environment. I don't imagine that, or has it gotten to the point where enough people want to go so that it has become a problem or anywhere near being a problem?
No, because Madagascar only gets about 100,000 visitors a year, which is very low. When you think of something like a single national park in the United States gets millions of visitors a year, it's still very low. And so I would strongly encourage people to go to Madagascar. The more ecotourism can be developed there, the better, because the local people really need the money, and actually so do the wildlife, and so do the plants and animals, because they need the protection. And the more people go there, the better.
Mm-hmm. What are the Malagasy people like?
They are some of the most gracious hosts, the most polite people you ever want to meet. They're just wonderful. They've got a very Pacific nature that's almost Buddhist in its orientation. And I count some of my best friends Malagasy who I've met and have seen several times on several trips. They're just wonderful people.
Mm. And how, you know, one wonders what they think about people who come to see the country, and whether they think there's anything unusual about that, or they just think that that's a natural impulse that people want to go and see the kind of places and creatures that they simply haven't seen before.
Well, certainly the Malagasy I have met have been very enthusiastic about foreigners coming. And I can't speak for the Malagasy as a whole. I don't know what the general public feels in a sense. I would imagine they don't give too much thought to it, because most people are farmers, out in the country. But certainly the people I've come in contact with, they're very enthusiastic about foreigners coming, and they're, as I said, they're very gracious hosts when you come.
Hmm. Has modern technology started to change the way that people live there?
I would say minimally. It's still a very poor country where, as I said, about 80% of the people are farmers, live out in the country, and they just don't have the money to build up the infrastructure, for instance. They also don't have great industries in Madagascar that could really bring in some foreign capital. And so I would say that technology is still sort of in its infancy in Madagascar.
Mm. Has there been, and we talked about the fact that that the environment is maybe the main resource of the place, and the fact that that it's the people are not wealthy, that nature constitutes their wealth. Has there been a problem with poaching, or with people either coming there to take stuff away, or people there, in a sense, being forced as a way of generating income to sell plants and animals to those people who are willing to pay money for that sort of thing?
Oh, yeah. There's a big black market in Madagascar for endangered species, and it's highly illegal, but it goes on apace. And there's a species called the radiated tortoise that's down in the Spiny Desert. It's this big basketball-domed kind of shelled turtle that has a beautiful shell. And the prized specimens of those will go up for $10,000 in the States. And so the incentive is just too great for local Malagasy, who only get a fraction of that amount, of course, mm-hmm. Not to get involved. It's a very difficult situation.
And so what does the government, have they been able to do something about that?
Well, it's a difficult problem. Again, it's a matter of resources. So the government doesn't have the resources to really track down and break the back of this black market. The people who come in from the outside can just simply get too much money for these endangered animals not to come. So it's a pretty big market, and I would say it's not a good, a rosy picture for the future of these highly endangered species.
Mm-hmm.
Enterprised.
You talked about, I think at the beginning of the program, you talked about the fact that it was something, a place that you had wanted to go and maybe had wanted to go for a long time, simply because it's one of the most exotic, unusual places that on the face of the earth. Do you expect that this is a place that you're going to continue to go back to, and it's always now going to be a big part of your life?
I wouldn't be surprised. I keep thinking I'm all done with Madagascar, and then end up going there again, and it's perfectly all right by me, because it gets under your skin. It's just such a fascinating place, and because it is continent-like, there's always new things to discover there. And as I said, the people are wonderful, so I very much look forward to future trips.
Mm. Well, I think we'll leave it at that. We're at the end of the time. I want to say thanks very much for talking with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you, David.